It's the Security Weekly News, episode 189, if you can believe that. So welcome to the week of February 20, 2022. So that's like, you know, some kind of Kabbalah number or something there. 2202, 2022. And if you add them all up, it's like the same number of letters as in Lyndon Johnson or something. So it probably means the world is going to end in an hour. But we'll get the news in first. Clearview, Iran, the biggest bug bounty ever, stone panda, porn scamming, xenomorphs, chat attacks, and Jason Wood on this edition of the Security Weekly News.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals, by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week, your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
Monitoring and maintaining compliance is a never-ending struggle with a high price of failure. FireMon helps customers meet complex and varying compliance requirements. FireMon has fully customizable reporting, analytics, assessments, and dashboards to meet the compliance needs of any organization. With FireMon, compliance reports take a tenth of the time, and real-time continuous compliance eliminates the anxiety and headaches of audit preparation. Improve security outcomes by improving security operations with FireMon. Visit securityweekly.com/FireMon to learn more. Cyber criminals are working overtime. Last year in the fourth quarter alone, phishing attacks disguised as COVID testing information increased by 521%. Barracuda has identified 13 types of email threats and how cyber criminals use them to steal money from your company or personal information from your employees and customers. Find out about the 13 email threat types and how Barracuda can provide complete email protection for your teams, your customers, and your reputation. Get your free ebook at securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda. Barracuda.
All right, I'm Doug White. Welcome to the Security Weekly News. Well, everything old becomes new again or something like that. But remember the good old days when you ran a BBS and there was a folder where people could share files and somebody posted a file called StarTrek.exe that had a little C program inside of it that wiped your hard drive when you executed it because you thought you were going to play the cool Star Trek game? No, I don't remember that either. But apparently, attackers, I put the story in because, not because it's so dramatic, but because it really reminded me of that. But apparently, attackers are logging into Teams accounts and handing out free executables to anyone interested in the chat. So, you know, you jump in a Teams session, post a link or an actual file in the chat, say, here, download this, and yeah. So Avanan identified that thousands of attacks had started in January, and they were mostly in the Great Lakes region of the United States, which sounds, I mean, I know where that is, sort of, but I mean, it's a pretty big area. But it was mostly targeted at local media outlets. So I guess that means like local TV affiliates and radio stations. But anyway, the malware that they were using is a file called user-centric. But I certainly don't expect it to always be called that, and it could be called anything you wanted, right? It's in the chat. It basically installs a bunch of DLLs and establishes a persistent Trojan system once somebody downloads it and clicks it. It's also a exfiltration tool, so it collects all the system information and the state of the operating system and sends all that back home. So it is recommended by this article. So this is a good article if you want to send it to your people. It's got some good tips that are related to these things. Because people don't think about this. They're in a chat with their boss or whatever, and somebody logs in. I mean, we all in Teams meetings and other types of Zoom meetings or whatever all the time. They all have chats. People are always posting stuff in chat. I have students who will post things in chat and say, check this out or whatever. And I'm like, I don't even know who some of these names are. So, you know, you can't have to be careful with that. But it's recommended that you force all files to be run in a sandbox and inspected, that you have full site security that includes scanning Teams, and of course, train your users. Most modern users don't know what a BBS is, and they probably never downloaded StarTrek.exe and got to play those games. But that is how lots of us learned about this stuff, was when it was going on way back when. Xenomorph malware is distributed through Google Play Store. And according to this article, it's already infected more than 50,000 devices. The malware, which runs on Android devices, steals banking information. So this is this particular version apparently is targeting dozens of financial institutions in Spain, Portugal, Italy, and Belgium. The company Threat Fabric analyzed the code, and they found that it was incredibly similar to the alien banking Trojan. And I guess that's why they gave it that name. They believe that Xenomorph is probably a successor to Alien. Although, to me, if you're going to go down that road, a more appropriate name might have been Prometheus. But okay, Prometheus haters, you be you. But anyway, the malware was embedded in a place in several different Playstore apps, apparently, and they all appear to be legitimate. They were mostly focused on like improving performance. And, you know, so it sounds, again, it sounds like that old Star Trek thing again, right? And a particular app they reported on was called Fast Cleaner, which had more than 50,000 downloads and contained the Xenomorph banking Trojan. The report says that Xenomorph is not fully developed yet. So I don't know, is it the little Xenomorph or the really big one, or, you know, the one that the cat was at? It gets complicated. But they said they didn't think it was fully developed, and it appears that they were just testing it. And it was targeting, according to the first part, it said dozens, and then it later said targeting 56 different European banks. The malware can do all kinds of tricks, so it can intercept notifications, in particular SMS messages, and it can also conduct overlay attacks, so that would let it bypass multi-factor. So if it's got your banking information, it's probably got your login information, and now it can do an overlay attack on your device, well, guess what? That's bad. So it immediately, when it's installed, reports a list of installed packages on the infected device, and that allows it to download the proper overlay files. It does when you run it, it requests accessibility service permission. And of course, if you're installing Fast Cleaner, you probably aren't thinking that much about it having Trojans built into it. So you probably tell it, yes, go ahead. My device is running really slow. But once that happens, it's able to use an exploit to grant itself additional permissions. If you're interested in this malware, there's a whole lot of detail about it in that particular article. All right, so porn scamming. I said it. I mean, how could I not say that? I saw this headline. I was like, oh, there's no way I can avoid this. It's just, you know, I think porn scams have probably been around as long as porn has been around. You know, somebody said, hey, Thog, I saw you over there in the cave yesterday. You sure wouldn't want me to tell all the other cave people what you were looking at, those graphic pictures you drew on the wall. But, you know, I mean, people have always been looking at porn. I mean, even before the internet and so forth, people looked at porn. People went to adult bookstores and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, adult bookstores always had guys in raincoats with their hat pulled down over their head, shuffling through the door and so forth, because they didn't want anybody to see them. And, you know, people don't like people to know they're looking at porn today, but they probably are. So, you know, we can skip all the graphic details. But scams have evolved around this. So basically, there's a couple of different types of porn scams that you see out there. There's real porn scams, so that are based on, you know, actual data, or not data, actual evidence, and there's just total fraud porn scams. So the real ones basically use cam people. I don't know what the correct term for that is, but cam people. And the cam people contact you and say, hey, why don't we chat? You know, you look hot or whatever. And then, you know, you basically agree to exchange virtual bodily fluids on camera. And, you know, guess what? They record you, and then later they contact you. And some guy named Steve from Long Island calls you up and says, hey, if you pay me $5,000, I won't send this video of you with this cam person to everybody you've ever known. You know, and, you know, eventually they get all your money, and then they typically send it anyway just for fun. The other kind, the total fraud kind, is where they basically just assume that you have a webcam, which you probably do, and that you have at some point looked at porn, you know, and they don't really have a lot of other details beyond that, but they just assume that at some point you looked at porn with your computer. All right. So this particular scam they were pointing out, they basically make an accusation that they have acquired your password. This was in French. They make an accusation that they have your password and that malware was installed on a porn site that you were using. They didn't even get into specifics. They're just like, a porn site you were using. And, you know, they're just hoping you're going, yes. And so basically what it says is you have viewed illegal cyber porn, whatever that is, and they have got this notification system, and it's a graphic. So you get this big thing in French, and it's a graphic, and there's a link on it. But because it's a graphic, the links don't get caught by the filters, and they advise you to contact them and are allowing you the chance to explain why you were looking at illegal pornography. So, yeah, it's nice and vague. So people are going, oh, no, and, you know, et cetera. And we've seen these kind of things before. But so you can, you know, then presumably you can log in and say it was for educational purposes. I swear I would, you know, I was just following a link because I saw my cousin's name on there. And I was like, you know, I'm going to check that out. But anyway, the link, of course, is a phishing scam. And I really just wanted to mention it to you because it is a good idea to advise your employees and your people about this type of thing so that they know what to expect and what it's going to look like when they get it. It's a good article to provide them because if you don't want to write something yourself, it's fairly simply written and it explains it quite well. And these scams do really panic people. I've gotten those calls, you know, where they're going, I'm not for me, but I'm asking for a friend. You know, is it possible someone accessed my webcam and recorded me? I mean, I wasn't doing anything. I mean, my friend wasn't doing anything. And abusing hummus in your private residence is not illegal here. Anyway, I mean, my friend wasn't abusing hummus, and I would never abuse hummus. But, you know, if you were, and it was recorded. Yeah. So anyway, the article is very reasonable for your users. So check it out. Stone Panda is an APT associated with the Chinese government, APT-10, in fact. They have been attacking Taiwan's financial sector. Now, if you haven't heard, China and Taiwan don't like each other very much. You know, I mean, it goes way back, Sun Yat-sen, Chiang Kai-shek, and all that stuff long, long time ago. And Taiwan broke off, formed their own country, and China didn't recognize them, and you know, and they're really close together, and you know, so Taiwan's right there, and you know, you can look across the water and see China, and China's over there going, "Hi, you're still part of us, really?" And you know, have you seen Hong Kong lately? You keep it up. But anyway, a wave of attacks appeared to peak around the middle of February, according to a report from a Taiwanese cybersecurity firm called SciCraft. They reported that this was really a supply chain compromise, and it was being used to target financial institutions in Taiwan. And it said with abnormal cases of placing orders. So that sounded like it had been translated. But I mean, it sounds, there's another story this week that's similar to that. The exploit was a vulnerability in the web management interface of a piece of software that was pretty much only used by the financial industry in Taiwan. And that particular piece of software, which is proprietary, is used by more than 80% of the Taiwanese financials. So, you know, obviously an exploit there would be pretty important. It can be exploited to deploy a shell that will allow Quasar Rat to be installed on the system, which basically allows exfiltration of all sorts of sensitive information from these banking tools. Quasar Rat is an open source tool, so it's widely available. You know, this is the future of warfare. We're seeing that in the Ukraine as well. I didn't have a single story about the Ukraine today. I think there's plenty of those out there. But basically, we're seeing these similar kind of things going on around the world where you're starting to see more cyber attacks related to this. Fewer tower flybys with fighter planes, more cyber attacks. So, you know, figure it out. There was another article this week about open source code. And I put this one in there because of the previous one and another story. But basically, you know, This article is talking about how open source will be the next big source of attacks, as if it isn't already. I mean, I completely agree with what they're saying. I'm not sure it's news to anybody. I mean, I love open source, and most of us love the idea of being able to see the code we're using, so you're not just buying, you know, proprietary modules that you have no idea what they do. And of course, sometimes they're free, sometimes they're not free, but at least you can see what you're using. And I've always had the attitude that hiding things doesn't really hide anything. And it just makes it an easy excuse that no one can see it, right? I mean, and then, of course, somebody figures it out. I like the idea that the algorithms we're using are being seen and vetted, and other people can comment on them and say, you know, you probably shouldn't use this stupid thing because it's got all these problems. But the real problem that they were talking here is really more of a supply chain problem, a la the previous story, in the sense that, you know, the problem is exacerbated by open source model. I mean, it's the same old thing, embedded layers that all contain various and sundry things that weren't necessarily coded by me that I'm now embedding in my code. And, you know, I go get stuff here and there. So if you're, but I mean, you know, think about it. You're writing code and you find this really awesome thing on GitHub that allows you to interact with Turtle Beach sound cards. Like, this was something that happened to me a long time ago, and I was trying to find something like this. It's open source. The code is there. It was written by DongSlayer69, and it's got 2,000 downloads. So I download it. Suddenly, it's in the Turtle Beach sound card driver, and suddenly my computer works. Yay! Okay, cool. Then my software gets bought. This part didn't actually happen except in my mind. Then my software gets bought up by Turtle Beach because they're saying, wow, now we have an interface to this mixing board, and they distribute it to 100,000 military users around the world who are also using their sound tools. So too bad there was a fatal flaw in DongSlayer's original app that you downloaded. So GitHub and such has really brought all those old promises of reusable code home. But at the same time, they brought all those old promises of maybe not so great coders writing lots and lots of code, and you don't know which ones are good and which ones are not so good. And, you know, and I do love reusable code. I do. But the problem is, I don't know who's developing it. I don't know what problems are there and so forth. And it turns into a waterfall where Turtle Beach bought it from me. They embedded it, and then they sold the embedded stuff to someone else, and suddenly they're using it, and all of a sudden your Tesla is running turtlebeach.exe. The Linux Foundation did announce in October that it raised $10 million, which doesn't sound like a very big number anymore, $10 million to help identify and fix vulnerabilities in open source software, and they were going to develop tooling, training, research, etc., all for $10 million. Well, it doesn't sound like that much to me, but at least I guess it's a start. A $250,000 U.S. dollar bug bounty was paid out, which is apparently the largest bug bounty ever paid. That was for a vulnerability in Coinbase that would basically allow someone to sell currency they don't own. So Tree of Alpha was the company that spotted her. That's a person, maybe. They spotted this in Coinbase, and they did get the largest bug bounty paid out so far. The bug was a missing logic validation check in a component of this called Retail Brokerage API Endpoint. So this is a part, I don't know this software, but it's probably the piece of it that's allowing buys and sells or whatever. But basically what it did was it allowed somebody to submit a trade that had a mismatched source account. So essentially they could sell something from your account with the money for the sale going into their account. And so basically they could trade currency to themselves and take it out of yours, and, you know, and then your currency's gone. It was demonstrated in the article, and the bug did allow the researchers to essentially manipulate trades to sell things they didn't own. So, ouch. Iranian state broadcasting service IRIB was hit with a cyber attack in January of 2022, which the details of which were released this week. The attack was a deployment of a wiper malware and custom implants onto a bunch of Iranian broadcast network stuff. Several different waves of attacks had been targeting Iranian infrastructure have been being carried out this year. The aim of this attack in particular appeared to be to disrupt TV and radio networks. In a 10-second attack on 27 of January, pictures were pushed out on the networks in a loop, which showed opposition party leaders and a call for the assassination of the Supreme Ayatollah of Iran. The attack did include custom malware that would allow taking screenshots of various screens in different computers, and it also did it installed Trojans on various computers, and there were other malicious executables found throughout the network. Checkpoint, which is based in Tel Aviv, reported the attacks, and they said that attribution at this time was not possible, and they don't know how anybody originally gained access to IRIB. A batch script was used to delete an executable in the system that was replaced with a video file, which was being triggered by, I guess, the normal operating procedure. And when that file was triggered, it just started playing this in a loop. They ran wipers, which was probably trying to keep anybody from actually being able to stop this and so on. It's a very interesting thing. And there's a lot of details in the article about it. Well, competitors in the mostly unclothed skeleton race, and I translated the Chinese name of that, they're very literal, but competitors in that race wear only a thong-like ribbon for modesty, and part of the challenge of the sport is surviving Arctic temperatures, blowing abrasive ice crystals, and the proximity of all your bits to razor-sharp skeleton blades. He luged for glory representing the Kingdom of Tonga and earned a bronze medal. Welcome, Jason Wood.
And let me tell you, when you crash, it is no fun. So this story was one I picked up from the Register. When you think about law enforcement and getting involved in a situation, typically this, you know, we at least here in the U.S., we operate on the model that somebody's called the cops after something has happened. And at that point, they're looking to do an investigation and determine whether or not somebody should be prosecuted and arrested. However, this article in the Register notes that times are changing to an extent, at least at the U.S. Department of Justice. And this is according to a speech by Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco. She gave this last week at the last Thursday at the annual Munich Cybersecurity Conference. And I guess they've done this for about 8 years or so. And that she did have reference to the Ukraine. So if you want to get your Ukraine references in the show, just go read the speech. Anyhow, in her speech, she commented that basically criminal activity as far as online in the online world is much more complex than, you know, law enforcement agencies have faced typically in the past. Primarily because a lot of these, as they're calling it, you know, cyber investigations have an international component. In fact, as a quote, she says, it's rare the cyber investigation that does not have an international dimension, end quote. So this comment really doesn't surprise me. I doubt it surprises you or anybody else who's listening to the show. But basically, she's acknowledging that, hey, e-crime has become a hot mess for us. They're not really well set up. Law enforcement, as it's typically done, is not really well set up to handle some of this because, well, people who are committing these crimes are in other countries and we can't get at them to arrest them, and therefore decrease the amount of threat out there, the threat actors that are committing these intrusions. In fact, she went on to say that a lot of these operations are a mix of countries and criminal organizations that are working together in what she called an alliance or alliances of convenience to carry out their attacks. Again, really looking at. All right, my sound just freaked out. Hopefully that came back. But the nothing new there. If you're reading threat intelligence about a lot of this stuff, you're hearing how countries are and criminal gangs are working together. The part that did catch my attention though was where, and it did for the Register as well, when Monaco laid out a change in priorities and actions that will be taken at the Department of Justice. Pretty much what she's saying is that there's going to be more emphasis put on disrupting crimes and criminal operations before they can take place against victims, even if that means that they have to decrease the chances that they have of arresting somebody or tipping somebody off to some access they have or capabilities they have. This is definitely a big change, particularly in her case. She observes she's a prosecutor, so the idea of not prosecuting is a little foreign. But essentially, they want to get out there and try and disrupt operations before they occur, before somebody can do another campaign of ransomware en masse. And honestly, as I was reading through this, I was thinking that this is also probably a little bit of an acknowledgement of things that are already occurring that we've seen in the news. And she makes some references to those. One example she cited was last year when the United States got back $2.3 million in cryptocurrency of the ransom paid by Colonial Pipeline to get access back to their billing systems. And this was seized from a crypto wallet that the U.S., the law enforcement or somebody in the U.S. had access to. Now, while I personally cheered that action because I thought that was absolutely hilarious, I was also surprised to hear that the DOJ had that level of access into a wallet, and more surprised to hear that they were willing to act on it like this and tip their hand, show that they had it. Most of her speech, she was talking about following the money and how they're going to, do that, and some task force that were set up for that. The last section was really where she talked about some of the changes in priorities. And here is a quote that I'll read off from there. She says, "Now, one of the key things I learned after September 11th, when I was both at the FBI and as head of the National Security Division, it's that success is not prosecuting terrorists after an attack when families are grieving and their loved ones have been lost. It may be this is kind of the key part. It may be necessary to be sure, but the success is preventing attacks in the first place, and we need to apply that same thinking to our cyber investigation. So moving forward, prosecutors, agents, and analysts will now assess at each stage of a cyber investigation whether to use disruptive actions against cyber threats, even if they might otherwise tip off tip the cyber criminals off and jeopardize potentials for charges and arrests. And this caught my attention. In other words, before we bring charges, we'll assess whether a step we can take to prevent or reduce the risk to victims, like providing the decryptor keys or seizing servers to use cyber attacks for further cyber attacks. Now, so basically, what got me here was just this is reading like, hey, arrests are nice. We still want to do that. And she makes a comment about that later. But the Department of Justice is going to change their mission a little bit. And now they are looking at, hey, where can we disrupt these actions, even if it means we'll never be able to arrest somebody or try them in court, which probably wouldn't happen very much anyway, because most of the time they're in other countries where getting to them is really difficult anyway. The idea that they would know about infrastructure like servers and app, you know, systems that are out there being used to facilitate these attacks, not really a surprise to me. But her comment about releasing decryption keys did. It seemed to indicate to me that in the past they had decryption keys and they kind of held them close because it's evidence and, you know, victims are paying ransoms or whatnot while they had decryption keys. Or maybe this is just an acknowledgement of what happened last year after the Kaseya attack, where Kaseya began released the decryptor to victims of that ransomware attack to unlock their stuff. And there was no acknowledgement of really where that key came from. So maybe in this case, Department of Justice had access to that decryptor, and they decided to go ahead and release it publicly, though through, you know, somebody to handle it in the middle, not directly, to release that so that the, you know, the victims could unlock their data. Again, that's a pretty big departure. Most of the time when you read about things around evidence and things that people have seized as part of investigations or come across, they're not going to release that. It's not going to come up until trial. But here you're seeing, you know, maybe this is occurring. You know, this is what happened here. They actually had it and they decide, okay, big enough impact, we're going to release some of our evidence and to mitigate the impact to the victims. Now, the Register observed basically in their headline that the U.S. has decided to, and I quote, attack cyber criminals first and ask questions later, end quote. And it's in, you know, kind of their typical sarcastic tone that I love. And sure, it's I think it's a little bit of hyperbole in some ways. You know, like, there's obviously going to be a lot of questions that are going to be asked here. You know, do we want to give up this capability? Do we want to release this evidence? But, you know, obviously it's a reference to the fact that this is being done, you know, not in response to a court decision or a trial outcome, but now, you know, we're going to change this and try and move out ahead of this. I also thought it was interesting, as you're listening or reading through her speech, which I've got the link to in the show notes, they are actively recruiting allies from other countries to come and help out. You know, she makes a comment a number of times, the United States can't do this alone. No country can do this alone. We need to work together. So it sounds like she's recruiting for efforts in there. Honestly, I'm a bit curious to see how this is going to play out over time. This is, you know, I think a recognition of what needs to, you know, that, yeah, slow plotting investigation is not going to help the victims out. And there are things that they can do to mitigate the damage to them, potentially interrupt an attack before it happens because they see it coming. At the same time, you know, there's always part of me that looks at it and sit there and thinks, well, I mean, that's cool in this case, but where are we going to apply this rationale in other cases or other situations? And will that creep out? It's just something I always wonder about. There's a lot more that Ms. Monaco covered in her speech. So if you would like to check that out, go to the wiki and read the show notes. I got the link to the Register article as well as a link to the text of her speech. But again, times are changing at the DOJ. This is kind of an interesting, we've seen it playing out over the last year, obviously with some examples that we talked about here, but I'm curious to see how this is going to continue to evolve and impact on criminal operations like this. So go take a look.
All right. Thank you, Jason. Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's very interesting. It seems like they're finally getting the message at those levels to maybe this is really an issue and we're going to have to do something about it, that a hellfire bomb isn't going to take care of. So starting to see some response. All right. And finally, Clearview AI, speaking of controversy, Clearview AI is a company that makes facial recognition software that has particularly been sold to law enforcement around the world and has often had a lot of ethical controversies, including misuse by law enforcement, misuse by Clearview AI, acquiring pictures of you without your permission to be used against you, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very Minority Report, very Philip K. Dick kind of thing. But in a recent release, they were telling investors that they will have 100 billion facial photos in the database within a year. And they claim that almost everyone in the world will be immediately identifiable on their system. Now, if you do the math, that's about 14 photos for each of the estimated 7 billion people on Earth. So, you know, but in the presentation, they said they wanted to move beyond scanning for the police and also monitor gig economy workers and others. They also said they were moving beyond just facial recognition and were trying to identify people by their walks, gestures. They could detect locations from the photo background, and they were apparently able to scan fingerprints from a distance. So mix that with some police drones and you got Black Mirror. The controversial company, though, collects photos from social media without consent by scraping them, as well as pretty much any site that has pictures on it. This latest was just a presentation to attempt to raise funds from potential investors, and the company is under a lot of scrutiny from different directions. But you want Skynet? This is how you get Skynet. And that's the news. Thanks, Jason. I'll see you on Friday for the wrap-up show.